Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 234. Psychoanalysis in Ireland with Paul Moore. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
Ireland has a kind of a strange history with psychotherapy, because I think of the influence that the Catholic Church has had in Ireland for such a long time, where confession, was a very big part of the Irish experience. And in some ways, psychoanalysis and psychotherapy is like that. So there's a familiarity there with the concept, but it was held in a lot of suspicion by the Catholic Church. But recent events, we've had two major reports here in the last couple of years detailing, child sexual abuse of the clergy, perpetrated by the clergy on children, which, really, it's, I think, people are kind of moving away from the church a lot. And I think, psychotherapy is starting to come back into the public eye more now.
That was the voice of my guest, Irish psychoanalyst Paul Moore. Paul Moore, BA, Psychology, and Masters of Philosophy and Masters of Science, is a psychologist and psychotherapist working in private practice in Dublin, Kilkenny, and Carlow, Ireland. Paul is also a lecturer in psychology, teaching introductory psychology and social psychology at the undergraduate program at Carlow Institute of Technology in the Lifelong Learning Department. He teaches courses in the area of applied social studies and early childhood care and education studies. Paul studied at Dublin City University, where he obtained his primary degree, an honors bachelor in psychology. Toward the end of his primary degree studies, Paul gained some practical experience while working in a school for children with autism, using behavior modification methods. He also worked on an outreach program in the same discipline. While at the school, he conducted experimental research on play skills autism. Paul joined the Masters of Philosophy program in psychoanalytic studies in Trinity College, University of Dublin, studying a wide range of psychoanalytic theorists, and upon completion entered the clinical training program at St. James Hospital, Dublin, and the Department of Psychiatry, Trinity College, University of Dublin. This is an intensive program culminating in a professional clinical diploma and a Master of Science in Psychoanalytic Psychotherapy. The training included intensive infant observation, supervised clinical training, and ongoing twice-weekly personal analysis. Paul's area of interest is the intersection of neuroscience and clinical psychoanalytic practice, known as neuropsychoanalysis, with a particular interest in the dreaming mind-brain. He has researched this at the Institute for Neuroscience at Trinity College, Dublin. He also has an interest in neuroscientific and psychoanalytic approaches to autistic spectrum disorder, which he also researched extensively under the supervision of Professor Michael Fitzgerald, a consultant psychiatrist and a leading world authority on autistic spectrum disorder. Now, here's the interview. Paul Moore, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, Dave. Nice to talk to you today.
Well, it's good to talk to you again. I'm very excited to have you as a guest. You and I got to know each other when I conducted a workshop in Ireland back in 2005.
I hadn't realized it was that long ago.
Right. Well, you had been a Shrink Wrap Radio listener, as I recall, and you let me know that you'd be attending the workshop, and so I hit you up for a ride from Dublin to the Chrysalis Retreat Center in County Wicklow, and as a result of that, we got to know one another and became fast friends.
That's right, yeah. It was a very eventful meeting, I suppose, and we hit it off very well from the very start,
yes,
as I recall.
Yes, we did, and it's hard to believe that it's been 5 years. Now, you were still a student at that time, undergoing your training analysis. and running your own construction business.
That's correct, yes. That's times have changed. There's been big changes since that time.
Really? How about the construction business? Do you still have that, or now that you're a psychoanalyst, have you let go of that?
I've let go of that now around two years ago now. So
okay.
I'm well away from the construction industry at the moment.
Well, that's a pretty unusual background for a psychoanalyst, I think. And I know you come from a working class background originally. So tell us how you got interested in psychology and then in becoming an analyst.
I was always interested in psychology, I suppose. Even as a child, I would have read quite a lot. I was quite an avid reader as a child, and kept up that interest in reading, I suppose. And always interested in, I suppose, questions of, you know, how people work, I suppose, people's minds work, and human interaction and subjects like that. And I remember somebody who I worked with in a hotel job, who was doing psychology as part of their course, gave me a loan of an introductory text. I think it could have been Gleitman or some such text.
Uh-huh.
And I read it in a matter of a couple of nights. I just really got absorbed in the material and really enjoyed it. So it was very, you know, I suppose a very early connection to it. But at the time, I wasn't really in the position, or I suppose in the right frame of mind even, to pursue a career in psychology. And that didn't come around till quite a bit down the road.
Really? Yes. And so you were working at the hotel at the time, and somebody just gave you this book.
That's right, yeah. It was a kind of a part-time job in conjunction with school, say school hours or college hours in the States. So, yeah, you know, and I suppose I was really interested to see that you could find all this information in the one subject area. That my interest to a new level then at that stage.
So how did you get interested in psychoanalysis per se? Because you could have studied psychology without necessarily becoming an analyst, and I assume you could even become some other kind of therapist without being an analyst. Is that right?
That's right. I could have, I suppose, taken many routes, but I suppose just to maybe tell you a little about what happened between reading that first psychology text, studying psychology formally. I left Ireland and I worked construction as a steel fixer for approximately around 10 years in London and in the UK, and then later in Australia and in New Zealand. Mm. And eventually arrived back in Ireland and settled down for a while. And once I was located in the one spot for a period of time, I decided to, you know, to study psychology formally. And I did a part-time degree in humanities, where psychology was the main subject that I studied there, along with philosophy and literature. And it was during that time that really I became interested in psychoanalysis. And after finishing that degree, I went on and I applied for a position on an MPhil in psychoanalytic studies in Trinity College in Dublin.
MPhil, would that be like Masters of Philosophy?
Masters of Philosophy, yeah.
Yes, okay.
And it's kind of a broad theoretical approach, you know, to different theories in psychoanalysis, which really got my interest there going in that, because I wasn't sure at that stage whether I was going to go on clinically to pursue it further. But after that, when I completed that, I got accepted onto the clinical training program, which was great, and just started the clinical training then.
Yes. So what's required then to become an analyst in Ireland? I know in this country, you know, usually it requires a medical degree, though not always. And so I guess the rules are different there.
Yeah, no, you have to have, you know, psychology background, or, you know, social work, or medical background, on a good honours degree, in your primary degree, and some relevant experience, which I had managed to pick up along the way. I worked with children with autism for 2 years. I gave up the construction industry and went back and worked in a school for children with autism, which is quite a big leap for me.
Yes,
and mainly a behavioural orientation.
Okay,
so it was good clinical experience. And I suppose a good experience of a different perspective in psychology as well.
Yes.
So when I mentioned to them that I wanted to pursue an MPhil in psychoanalysis, their eyes were rolling up towards heaven. They weren't too sure exactly what I was doing there.
Why was that?
Because of the behavioral.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Orientation and, you know, such notions of, you know, as the unconscious and mentalization and things like that were pretty much unheard of.
Yes, right. Bad words.
Exactly.
Yeah. So how is psychoanalysis practiced there in Ireland? For example, do you have the client recline on a couch? Do you use Freud's free association technique, or have things evolved past all that?
Yeah, we still use the couch, where possible. People are invited to use the couch. And if they're comfortable with that, that's okay. But if not, we use chairs, and then with a view to moving onto the couch. But where possible, we try to get people onto the couch. And we still would use Freud's free association techniques, but I suppose my background and my training was heavily influenced by what's known as the independent school, which comes out of the British psychoanalytic tradition. In the 30s and 40s, when Freud went to London, and then Melanie Klein arrived in the British Psychoanalytic Society, there was a big split in the camp, and they kind of decamped into two factions. And there was a kind of a rapprochement of sorts, where people didn't want to go into either camp and decided to take a neutral stance, if you like, and that became known as the British Independent School. So my training will be heavily influenced by that. So it's quite an eclectic.
That's fascinating. That's some background historically that I wasn't aware of. Now, I think you were the first person from whom I heard the term neuropsychoanalysis, and I've run into it since and wanted to get a guest on that topic. And so here you are. You're the guest.
it's come full circle.
Yeah. So what is neuropsychoanalysis?
Neuropsychoanalysis is, I suppose, the joining of the two disciplines of neuroscience and psychoanalysis, where both approaches are coming at the same subject, if you like, from different perspectives, where the neuroscience approach would be very kind of an objective approach at the functions and the localizations of different functions in the brain, and the psychoanalytic approach would be looking at the functions and the workings of the mind. Both, I suppose, members from both professions or both disciplines have come together in a joint venture to further the understanding of the mind stroke brain.
Yeah, of course, Freud was a neurologist, and
that's right, yeah.
And I think he had hoped that his theories would eventually become more rooted in the physiology of the brain. And you sent me a couple of papers that you've written. I was very intrigued by them, and you trace the evolution of neuropsychoanalysis all the way back to Freud. Maybe you can take us through some of the high points from Freud on.
I suppose Freud is a famous paper, known as the Project in psychoanalytic circles. He had a working title because it was published posthumously. He had a working title called the Project for a Scientific Psychology, where he really worked a lot of his ideas or his theories about the workings of the mind on a neurological level. So even before Charles Sherrington had described the synaptic junctions in between nerve cells and in circuits, Freud had a similar idea that he communicated to his friend Wilhelm Fleiss in several letters. But the actual paper itself wasn't published until, it was the 1950s sometime. So he abandoned his project around the 1900s and gave up on trying to follow it through, concentrating instead on his dream interpretation techniques and just developing his theories from clinical practice. I suppose he was very limited or restricted by the technology of the time as well, but. A lot of his insights have been shown to be not too far off the mark. He had a pretty amazing understanding of the workings of the brain, just from a clinical observation. with patients.
Well, can you give us an example of one of his observations that was not far off the mark in that regard?
His ideas about dreams and the function of dreams, and how somehow, you know, that there were there was this transcribing or a conversion of the impulses and the drives in order to express them in a safe way, and not to wake up the person, and to make sense or meaning of, you know, of the experience of a person's experience. There's quite a bit of research now in the area of learning and memory consolidation. A neuropsychologist and psychoanalyst, Mark Solms, who would be one of the leading figures in neuropsychoanalysis, has done quite a lot of work in this area, on the area of what are known as dopaminergic circuits. There's this kind of a seeking function that seems to be activated during dreaming, where instincts and drives are expressed, if you like. So parts of the brain that can be seen activated during seeking behavior, such as hunger and thirst, also get activated during REM sleep and non-REM sleep in dreaming. So he, you know, from that point of view, you know, he was able to deduce that from his clinical observations with patients.
Well, I think it's intriguing that there are neuroscientists now who are kind of on the frontier of that research, who are correlating it with some of the kinds of processes and ideas that Freud and later psychoanalysts talked about. It's still pretty controversial, though, isn't it? Or not?
In what terms?
Well, I think that there are people who just dismiss psychoanalysis, anything related to it, just kind of dismiss it out of hand, and would think that the idea that there could be any scientific validity at all would be a far-fetched notion. Maybe you haven't run into that.
Yeah. Oh, no, I have. I've run into that regularly. I suppose particularly in relation to, you know, the effectiveness of psychoanalysis as a, you know, as a treatment, and it's an area that I'm very interested in for obvious reasons. It's always intrigued me that there's such a bias, if you like, you know, at the moment in psychology towards psychoanalysis, and I think it has a long history. I think psychoanalysis and psychoanalysts probably didn't do themselves any favors. You know, back in the early times of psychology, you know, where there were these strict, I suppose, requirements upon people that, where you had to be a member of the medical profession, which I don't think is so much the case now. But psychoanalysis seemed to split away from psychology,
yes,
if you like, and follow its own course. And then with the onset of behaviorism, they distance each other further again. But there's a reemergence now, I think, as well, a slight reemergence in, you know, psychoanalytic concepts and using psychoanalysis as a treatment. And there's quite a bit of research going on at the moment. There's a paper just published in the American Psychological Society's journal. Is it the Journal of the American Psychological Society, I suppose, is what it's called. But by a guy called Jonathan Shedler, who's from Colorado University, the effectiveness of psychoanalysis, how preconception, if you like, in people's minds about CBT and cognitive therapies being evidence-based,
yes,
treatments.
Yes.
Where he's actually shown, you know, through quite strict meta-analysis, that psychoanalytic therapies are just as effective as CBT and cognitive-based cognitive therapies. And that when you go into a follow-up treatment, do treatment follow-ups, long-term treatment follow-ups, psychoanalytic therapies are actually more effective.
Well, that's fascinating. You know, if you think of it, and you can find a reference or a link to that paper, send it to me, and maybe I'll be able to line him up as a guest. I think that would make a really fascinating topic.
And what's even more interesting is that he attributes the possibility that some of the better CBT therapists maybe getting such good results because they use unwittingly or not psychoanalytic techniques in their practice.
Yes, and you know, in my other series, Wise Counsel podcast, I've interviewed a couple of people who have done work building theories that integrate cognitive behavioral with psychoanalytic concepts, and I'm blocking on their names at the moment.
Yeah, I recall the episodes, but I don't recall the names either.
Yeah, right, yeah. And I apologize for that. But now a specialization of yours is autism, I guess, as a result of that two-year experience that you had working in that center. And I wouldn't think that autism would submit to what most of us would think of as psychoanalytic therapy. But in one of the papers that you sent me, you point out that it's because of misconceptions about psychoanalysis that people would not expect it to be a fit with autism. So how do you view autism, and how does psychoanalytic theory view it? How would those two come together?
Well, I suppose the traditional view of autism before Leo Kanner first identified the syndrome, which is around 1943, was that it was a childhood psychosis, was how it was categorized in the literature, if you like. But Melanie Klein would have worked, one of her famous cases is with a four-year-old boy named Dick. In the 1930s, his presentation fitted well with, you know, Kanner's description of autism, you know, where there are, you know, severe social impairments, language impairments, also, I suppose, a physically normal appearance, stereotype behaviors, a desire for sameness in routines and in play objects.
Yes.
That you know, there's this routineness or sameness in the environment. I suppose Klein, what's unusual about Klein and what people might not realize is that from the very outset, she realized that, you know, this wasn't a psychogenic disorder, if you like, that, you know, there were constitutional factors at play. You know, there was an organic component. Mm-hmm. To the child's presentation. And also, she realized that you needed to use different techniques, and that it probably could not be treated with psychoanalysis alone, that it needed a multidisciplinary approach. And she would have worked very much with, you know, in the area of play therapy and art therapy with that child and with children in general. But I suppose psychoanalysis has a bad rap, I think, you know, from the misunderstanding of the theory and the theories around it. And there was one particular analyst, Bruno Bettelheim, who didn't do psychoanalysis any favors either, where he coined the term refrigerator mothers about the mothers of children with autism, which is untrue, and most psychoanalysts would not agree with that was a, you know, that a mother's was responsible for their child's autism. I suppose the contemporary thinking would be that it is very much, you know, constitutional matters, and that as a result of these constitutional matters that there is, you know, an impairment in the development of the child.
Yes, in fact, in one of the papers that you sent me, you talked quite a bit about the amygdala and the role that it plays, which kind of brings us back to the neuropsychoanalysis. Say a little bit about the amygdala in relation to autism.
The amygdala is a part of the brain that's situated, I suppose, deep inside the brain, and at a very ancient level of organization, evolutionarily wise. I suppose it's got many projections from the amygdala to various different parts of the brain, and it's involved in a kind of a monitoring role. It's also involved in, you know, social mediation between people. It's also involved in motor skill development, and it seems to be involved in nearly everything, you know, where there are impairments in autism. Mm-hmm. Post-mortem investigation of the brains of people with autism have shown abnormalities in the amygdala, where there's an increased density in a lot of areas of the amygdala. This is, I suppose, led to the suggestion that it may be a hyper-arousal or a hyperactive amygdala that is not processing the emotion correctly, and particularly fear. That children who have autism may be particularly fearful of other people and may not show appropriate fear for objects, I suppose, would manifest itself then, you know, in children with autism, where there is a extreme aloneness that Kanner talks about, where they don't appear to be able to connect with other people socially and have a preference for objects that are cold or solid, as opposed to warm, you know, the usual typical teddy bears or cuddly toys that the children might play with.
Yes. That's fascinating. Now, do you see Asperger's as part of the autism spectrum or as a distinctive diagnostic entity unto itself.
Interesting that you should ask me that. I've always considered it Asperger's as a high-functioning level of autism, if you like, where it's autism is on a spectrum, what's known as the autistic spectrum disorder. But there's the draft copy of the DSM-5 has been released, I think, in the last week or so. And one of the changes in it is that the removal of Asperger's as a distinct category. And I think, I haven't read it completely, but I presume that would be in line with the thinking around Asperger's being a form of high-functioning autism.
Okay.
Where, you know, where language is there, and there's good language ability, but there are impairments maybe in the social areas.
Yes. Now, in your paper, you cite research evidence from the Tavistock Clinic that a psychoanalytic approach can be helpful, at least in some cases of autism. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I didn't warn you ahead of time to have your paper in front of you. And I know sometimes if people were to ask me about things that I've written, I wouldn't necessarily be able to speak about it very fluently. I wouldn't remember. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I read things that I wrote some time back and I go, did I write that? I don't even remember writing that. But you talked about in there about a study by Peter, and I don't know how to pronounce his last name, Fonagy?
Fonagy, Peter Fonagy.
Peter Fonagy and Mary Target.
That's right, yeah.
And that sounded like an important study, if you can recall it.
Yeah, I can actually. They conducted it was quite a detailed review of children who presented with what are known as psychosocial disorders, where there's, I suppose, an abnormality or an abnormality or a deficit, if you like, in social skills. And quite extreme abnormalities. And they may not necessarily have a diagnosis of autism, but a lot of children with a diagnosis of autism would fall into this category. You know, it's been shown that it's quite effective for these types of children, especially the intensive nature of, 4 or 5 times a week. Because psychoanalysis, whether it's with children with autism or anybody, is about putting meaning on experience. And meaning on one's own subjective experience and the behavior of others. And this seems to be consistent, I suppose, even with Shedler's recent paper about the effectiveness of psychoanalysis, that at some stage the process seems to get internalized and people are able to, I suppose, do little bits of analysis themselves. Really. And this is what this, it seems to give the children the skills and the tools to have a better understanding of their environment.
Yes.
Their own internal experiences.
Yes, and this is probably relevant. In the paper, you write, analysts who work with children introduce a mentalizing perspective that focuses on the child's mind as well as the mental states of people who are important to them.
Yeah. And it's quite a central topic or idea in current psychoanalytic thought at the moment, which would stem from Melanie Klein via a theorist called Wilfred Bion. I think one of your guests was speaking about Bion.
Yes.
Recently, Raoul Moncayo, the Lacanian guest that you had on.
That's right. Good memory. You probably understood him better than I did.
I really, really enjoyed that episode. It was very good. But Bion, his big idea, if you like, is about the container and the contained. That, in all our experiences, that we have someone who receives our thoughts, and in our very early experiences, our troubling thoughts or our anxieties are taken in by a mother or by a caregiver. Who can recycle them or detoxify them in some way. And Bion looks at it like also being a process that's internalized, if you like. But eventually, this is how we make sense of our environment, like the raw data that comes through your senses, gets made sense of by some part of your mind that is able to receive it and turn it into meaningful information, if you like, so they detoxify it in some sense, take the anxiety out of it. And this seems to be the same kind of process that's improved in children with autism, that they're able to mentalize, to symbolize the experience.
You emphasize that psychoanalysis is not a cure for autism, but should be part of a multimodal approach. What other sorts of people would you want to have on the team?
I suppose it'd be useful to say at this point that when I was writing that paper, I was lucky enough to work with Professor Michael Fitzgerald from Trinity College in Dublin, who is a renowned expert on autism and Asperger's. And he advocated, you know, the multimodal approach as well. And he's actually a psychoanalyst. There's a place, I think, for, you know, applied behavior analysis, you know, which is really a very intensive one-to-one working with children, which can improve certain skills. They can identify, you know, deficits in, you know, in the child's repertoire, if you like, and can work on those quite specifically. And also, art therapy, music therapy, has been shown to be quite effective, and occupational therapy. You know, lots of work on the proprioceptive system. Mm-hmm. All these different aspects need to be looked at with the individual. So emphasizing one approach, you know, really isn't the way to go. I think it's because, you know, there are so many different, you know, facets or aspects that are impaired, you know, with autism, that it really does take a global approach to affect any great change, really, any great lasting change.
Okay, well, that makes sense to me. You know, you were talking about dreams earlier, and as you know, I'm particularly interested in dreams. And I saw that you did your dissertation on the neuroscience of dreaming.
Mm.
What did you find out about that? And say something about your own interest in dreams.
I suppose, obviously, you know, working psychoanalytically with people, and in my own analysis, you know, I've come to understand, I suppose, on a very personal level, that there are, you know, the dreams are significant, and there are meanings in dreams, and that they hold, I suppose, some information or some insight, you know, to the person. So I was very interested to find out whether, you know, this notion, the popular phrase in psychoanalysis, and is Freud's term, that the dreams are the royal road to the unconscious, if you like, and that there are these aspects about our own experience that we don't fully understand, and that by gaining access to them, that, you know, we can find out more about ourselves and develop on a personal level. So I was interested to find out what the neuroscience take on dreams was and is. I suppose I discovered that what they're interested in really is this idea that the function, that neuroscience seems to be, you know, seems to address the function of dreams. You know, why do we dream? What functions do dreams have? And they've come to the conclusion that they play a learning and memory consolidation function in the brain, that there is this taking in of experiences during the day that are replayed in the mind, and it seems to be kind of a shunting process that goes from one part of the brain into, you know, the amygdala and the hippocampus, where it's coded for meaning, if you like. And then it's shunted up into the frontal cortex, where memories are in REM sleep are laid down in quite a detailed way. And there's various studies that have shown that, you know, tasks that are performed during the day, they're followed by a good night's sleep, that the tasks are improved the following day. They've also done studies where, you know, people were deprived of sleep and the tasks were shown not to improve, even if they made up the sleep in the following two nights. So there is that learning and memory consolidation aspect to the dreams, which kind of, you know, which in a way it ties in with the psychoanalytic concept, and especially Bion's notion of this kind of metabolizing of raw experience, and that some way that, you know, for us to make sense of our experience and of our world, that the experience has to be dreamed in some way first, and then it can be made available to thinking, which in some way is what is happening when these experiences are replayed at nighttime in dreams and on the neuroscientific level. So that's where I see dreams and neuroscience and psychoanalysis. Does that answer your question?
Yeah,
Dave?
Yeah, it does. What are your plans for the future as you look ahead? You know, what do you see as your own growing edge?
I'm still very interested in the area of dreams and neuropsychoanalysis, and I'm looking at the idea of doing a PhD in that area.
Oh, good for you.
So I would like to do, that's what I would like to do, is to get something going in that area. And ideally what I'd like to do is, I suppose, split my time between the clinical practice, research, and teaching. Recently, well, this is my second year now, I've gone back and I'm teaching in a college in Carlow, as an institute for technology, introductory psychology and social psychology, which I'm really enjoying at the moment. So that's where I see myself going, hopefully trying to find a nice balance between those three aspects of clinical practice, teaching and research.
You know, that's what back in 1942, I think there was something called the Boulder Conference that was held in Boulder, Colorado, where the American Psychological Association was struggling with to define what a professional psychologist should be. And what they came up with was exactly what you've described, that ideally a clinical psychologist would be someone who has skills and divides her time between clinical work, teaching, and I think research. So good for you. You've rediscovered it on your own.
I've just recently been asked to join a committee, the College of Psychoanalysis in Ireland. We're setting up a committee to, I suppose, promote psychoanalysis. Because currently over here, it's probably the same in the States. Everywhere you turn, it's, CBT, evidence-based approach, which is fine. I've no problem with that. But, I mean, there is, all this evidence out there at the moment for psychoanalysis as well. And I suppose psychoanalysts, for some reason, don't seem to be very adept at, answering to that or rising to that challenge, if you like, not even to compete with CBT, but to, just to, stake out your ground, really.
Yeah. Well, what about the image of psychotherapy generally in Ireland? Are people open to that in a widespread sense, or is psychotherapy still regarded with some suspicion?
I think it's not as bad as it used to be, because Ireland has a kind of a strange history with psychotherapy, because I think of the influence that the Catholic Church has had in Ireland for such a long time, where confession, was a very big part of the Irish experience. And in some ways, psychoanalysis and psychotherapy is like that. So there's a familiarity there with the concept, but it was held in a lot of suspicion by the Catholic Church. But recent events, we've had two major reports here in the last couple of years detailing, child sexual abuse of the clergy, perpetrated by the clergy on children. Which, really, it's, I think, people are kind of moving away from the church a lot. And I think, psychotherapy is starting to come back into the public eye more now. And we had a report there, the population of Ireland is around 4 million at the moment, and we had a report recently, around 3 or 4 years ago, where it was estimated that 300,000 up to at least 300,000 people had been abused in some form or another.
Wow, that's a shocking figure.
It is. It's quite astonishing, really.
So this is really, must be causing just an upheaval there in Ireland, and I imagine with some bitterness.
It really hasn't hit its peak yet, I don't think. I think people, for a lot of people, it really hasn't sunk in, the nature of the abuse and the betrayal. And I suppose the idea that these men of God, if you like, could do such a thing. And then there are people who were supposed to be in charge, such as bishops, who really knew what was going on, but just moved the perpetrators from parish to parish and never really addressed the problem. So there's all these knock-on effects as well. So it's really kind of shattered, I suppose, the people's confidence in the church.
That's interesting. And so in a way, the secular psychotherapy is almost kind of a secular, I don't want to say religion, but it speaks to maybe a similar place in the heart to some degree.
Oh, I think so. I think it's I suppose what comes to mind for me is this, again, this idea of beyond, and that, we, you know, in some sense, we all need something to contain us, you know, somewhere that we can kind of direct, you know, these raw elements of experience, these anxieties, if you like, and get some kind of, you know, detoxifying effect or a relief from them. So, you know, there's something that happens, you know, in the talking, you know, that really does help people.
Well, maybe that's a good place for us to wrap it up.
Okay.
Paul, I know that you also are a proud speaker of Irish, and as we end our session here, perhaps you could say a few words for us in Irish.
It's Misha Paula Morga, agus tatu ar an talag le Dr. Dahi, agus tatu ag eistach le radio shrink wrap. My name is Paul Moore, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave, and you're listening to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Of course, and I understood it perfectly. So, Paul Moore, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Okay, David, thanks very much.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with my Irish friend, Paul Moore. I think he may have been fairly nervous during this interview. I recall him speaking a lot more easily and freely when we met in person. Also at the time of this interview, it was 11 at night there in Ireland, and he had already put in a long day, not to mention getting his three young kids to bed. Paul did send me that paper that he mentioned. The title is The Efficacy of Psychodynamic Psychotherapy by Jonathan Shedler at the University of Colorado, Denver School of Medicine. It appears in the February-March 2010 issue of the American Psychologist. The thrust of the article is exactly as Paul described it. In fact, reading from the article's summary, it says, "Empirical evidence supports the efficacy of psychodynamic therapy. Effect sizes for psychodynamic therapy are as large as those reported for other therapies that have been actively promoted as, quotes, empirically supported and, quotes, evidence-based. In addition, patients who receive psychodynamic therapy maintain therapeutic gains and appear to continue to improve after treatment ends. Finally, non-psychodynamic therapies may be effective in part because the more skilled practitioners utilize techniques that have long been central to psychodynamic theory and practice. The perception that psychodynamic approaches lack empirical support does not accord with available scientific evidence and may reflect selective dissemination of research findings." End quote. And I think that's pretty much what Paul was getting across. I find this fascinating because I think there are large political forces at play in terms of what gets promoted as evidence-based and what does not. Shedler's research exposes the rather loud and out-of-hand dismissal of psychodynamic approaches. I definitely think I should seek out Jonathan Shedler. In fact, I've just sent him an invitation for wise counsel. So thanks to Paul Moore for bringing this to our attention.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
Hello, everyone. It's yet another beautiful day here in Northern California. If you've been listening to me for any length of time, you probably know that I'm pretty much a Macintosh fanatic. So, of course, I caught iPad fever and signed up to be among the first to have one delivered to my house on launch day, April 3rd, 2010, the day the world stood still. One of my main motivations was hoping that I might be able to use it for my upcoming PowerPoint presentation in Prague, which you will recall is coming up in mid-May. Well, I'm still fiddling with the device, and I'm not sure it's ready for prime time as a presentation tool. As they say, pioneers get arrows in their backs, and I'm feeling like a porcupine. Hopefully, the product and the keynote presentation software will evolve and mature as time goes by. What I'm missing most is that it doesn't show the presenter notes. You know, the notes that remind me what the slides mean, the details of all those research studies that I hope to talk about but fear not remembering. In every other respect, it's a pretty amazing little device. But PowerPoint-style presentations were the primary application of interest for me. Be sure to catch my interview with Dr. Robert Fancher on my other series at wisecounselpodcast.com, where you'll also find a written transcript right on the page with the audio interview. The focus of the interview is what he calls cultures of healing. He takes psychology and psychotherapy to task for pretending to have a stronger scientific base than is actually merited. He's a crusty fellow, and his trenchant criticism makes a lot of sense. Hey, I've got some late-breaking, exciting news to share with you. I've finished work on the CE course on positive psychology. So now, all you psychologists, social workers, counselors, and nurses, and others can earn 6 continuing education credits for licensure or relicensure by listening to 8 of my best interviews on positive psychology. The units are accredited by the relevant U.S. professional organizations, and this online course is offered through the Zur Institute. Just go to the store page on the Shrink Wrap Radio website, and you'll find the link to the course there. Zur is spelled Z-U-R, or Zulu Uniform Romeo. You can also go directly to my course by going to www.zurinstitute.com/positivepsychologycourse.html. Please tweet about this URL and pass it on to everyone you know who might be looking for CE units. And thanks. Speaking of continuing education credits, I'm pleased to share with you that I've been elected to Phi Beta Delta, which is the Honors Society of International Educators. I'm pleased to claim this recognition as an international educator, thanks to you listeners in more than 50 countries across the globe. Be sure to visit our Shrink Wrap Radio store, where you'll find not only t-shirts, but also some CDs that I've created for you. If you take a look at the Shrink Wrap Radio website, you'll see that I've removed all the advertising that was there, except for our Top Spots widget. This has been a leap of faith, and I'm moving ahead on the donation model. If you haven't donated and are able to do so, and I understand that not everybody can, it would be much appreciated. Just look for the big green button in the right-hand sidebar. And thanks to all of you who've made previous donations, both one-time and ongoing. If you have a cell phone, let me remind you that another way you can get these shows is through the Stitcher application, and you'll find a link to Stitcher on our website. And let me once again remind you to join our Yahoo discussion group. There's a banner link on our website in the right-hand sidebar, or you can simply send an email to shrinkwrapradio-subscribe@yahoogroups.com. Finally, please remember to tell your friends, colleagues, family, and so on about Shrink Wrap Radio, and I really appreciate it when you mention it on your blog, Facebook, or Twitter. And you can follow my tweets at twitter.com/shrinkwrapradio. Now, most of our shows have typed transcripts that you can download for free. Thanks to the volunteers who've made that happen, it provides incredible value. But we need more transcribers, so please contact me if you would be interested in being a volunteer transcriber.
Hi, this is New Mexico Jungian analyst Dr. Monica Wickman, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Dr. Monica Wickman, who will be my guest on our next episode. Now let's take a dip into the old email bag. First, we hear from Tom, who sent a note of appreciation through a website called Gratitude Log. He wrote, "Dr. Dave, just wanted to say that I really appreciate your high production values and dedication to exploring the world of psychology through your Shrink Wrap Radio podcast. Your thoughtful interviews and interesting guests help me to discover new and useful resources. Thank you, Tom." Thank you for that, Tom. And next we hear from Ruth, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I've been listening to your show for almost a year now, since I was given my first iPod for my birthday last year and discovered the delights of podcasting. I finally caught up with the shows after downloading some of your past episodes. It feels so much better to feel more up to date now. I really enjoyed the dream interpretations with Jane Anderson and was struck by how fast she came up with her ideas." Yes, I was too. She goes on to say, "I've dabbled in interpretations of my own dreams since my teens, a while ago. But after hearing her, I realized how much I complicate things for myself. Her quick interpretation of the soul and colors of your shoe has really inspired me to go back over some of my own dreams. Anyway, I'd like to congratulate you on such a great show. I've placed a link on my blog and spread the word in forums I visit here in the UK. Also, I would like to be a part of the discussion group, but I really don't want to have to sign up for a Yahoo email. Is there any way of joining the mail list? Oh, is there another way of joining the mailing list? Cheers, Ruth." And Ruth, I don't think there is another way to join the mailing list. I'm not sure what your reluctance is to sign up for Yahoo email. I don't think it means that you have to use it. You can come, you know, you can invent it, a kind of pseudonym. So I hope you find a way to do it. Next, we hear from John in Michigan, who writes, "Dr. Dave, thanks very much for providing the interesting interview with Jerry Ruhl. Speaking of topics Jungian, I'd like to suggest a candidate book as the basis for an interview. It's called The Matrix and Meaning of Character, an Archetypal and Developmental Approach, published in 2007 by Routledge. The two authors are Nancy J. Doherty and Jacqueline J. West. Both are Jungian therapists. Ms. Doherty lives in Naples, Florida, and is a member of the Florida Association of Jungian Analysts and also the Interregional Society of Jungian Analysts. Ms. West, according to the book, is with the Santa Fe Jungian Association. Both authors are also involved with programs that train therapists." That's interesting, the Santa Fe Jungian Association, because my next guest, Monica Wickman, is in Santa Fe and so must know that author. At any rate, he goes on to say, "The book is meant as a training reference. It provides a scheme relating character type defenses to developmental issues. The chapters include case study material along with myth and fairy tale stories, uses as metaphors to explain psychological dynamics, particularly Jungian approach. They also are careful to show how their scheme maps into and sometimes doesn't map into the more well-known categories and definitions of the DSM. This book combines theoretical topics and clinical experience in what was for me a very meaningful and educational experience. I'm not a therapist, but rather an interested amateur, always trying to learn more about others and myself. I found this book to be particularly useful in both regards. I think an interview based around the ideas in this book would make for a great program. I know most professional therapists now look at Jungian analytic therapy as, quote, old-fashioned, if not just plain wrong. This is a great way to show how many modern and Jungian diagnostic topics overlap. I knew Ms. Doherty when she lived in the Metro Detroit area during the 1980s and 90s. Best regards," and that's from John in Clawson, Michigan. And John, I'm impressed by the depth of your reading and your thinking. I'm always blown away by my listeners who describe themselves as amateurs and yet are immersing themselves in deep and challenging material such as you are. And I have put this on my to-do list. It may take me a long time before I get around to it, but I appreciate the suggestion. And here's one last one from a potential guest. Dear David, I hope this email finds you doing well. I'm a longtime listener and first-time emailer. I thought I would pass along information about my upcoming group in the Bay Area and some information about myself and my practice. I really enjoy listening to your show on my commute and appreciate the information you make available. Keep up the good work. Thank you. In the spring, I'll be facilitating a group for teens at my office in Berkeley, California. And he attached a flyer. This 12-week group with two parent meetings will address the advantages as well as the concerns about the role of the internet, video games, and cell phones in the lives of teens today. I take a positive approach to these issues, supporting kids by encouraging them to look for a common ground with their parents where they can communicate, find balance, and ensure a safer online video game and cell phone experience. I'm a family therapist with extensive training and experience in new media and technology. In addition to my counseling practice, I am the founder of Positive Technology Relationships, a program dedicated to helping families, schools, organizations, and communities in their efforts to bridge the screen divide. I have provided numerous parent education workshops and clinician-teacher trainings. In addition, I have worked with groups of teens and out of the consulting room with a focus on their social, emotional, and health development in regard to screen activities. If you would like any additional information, feel free to contact me. And he gives me his email and phone number. I'll give you his website in case you're interested in contacting. His name is Jason Brand, LCSW, and his website is www.jasonbrandlcsw.com. So that's a good suggestion, Jason. I appreciate yourself volunteering to be a guest here on Shrink Wrap Radio. And I have done a similar interview in the past, but I think it would be good to do another one. So I've added you to my to-do list as well. I think that better wrap it up for today. Remember, send me emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can Skype me at ShrinkPod. You can call me at 206-337-0622. Thanks to my good friend and guest, Paul Moore, for sharing his insight about psychoanalysis in Ireland. As I mentioned earlier, my next show will be with New Mexico-based Jungian analyst Dr. Monica Wickman. I invited her on the strong recommendation of Irish listener John Cavanaugh, who met her in a workshop in Ireland. He's right. She's a delightful guest who I'm certain you will enjoy listening to. So until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.